Well, good morning and happy Thanksgiving from WFERLP in South Royalton, Vermont, as the snow continues to fall, which is expected to wrap up around 7 or 8 p.m. tonight with a total possibly of 8 inches. So be careful out there. Just a reminder, if you are not having family and friends over and you're looking for a spot for a good Thanksgiving meal, the Vermont Law and Graduate School is providing Thanksgiving meal starting in just a half an hour or so, 11:30 on up until 1 p.m. at the Chase Center at the Vermont Law Graduate School here in South Royalton. Todd in with you here on a Thursday at 11 o'clock. Don't worry, I've got some good Thanksgiving plans for later, but glad to be here for Green Scene. Henry's visiting with some family today. We're going to be focusing quite a bit on trees, both musically and a special piece on old growth forest preservation and forestry practices in Vermont, courtesy of Vermont Digger. That'll be coming up in just a little bit. Starting out with music from Ecuador, and there's a fine story about an exchange student that came to Randolph, 25 years ago or so, and now is involved in her home country in Ecuador, working for forest restoration, clean water, clean air, and also climate justice. We'll cover that in just a little bit. Do want to thank the underwriters of Green Zine here, and they include Wit and Grit, a restaurant for breakfast and lunch in Randolph, Vermont. The White River Land Collaborative, located just across the border in Tunbridge, right up Route 110, first covered bridge you come to on the right. Solar Fest, First Branch Coffee Company, the Upper Pass Beer Company, Solaflect, Bale, and Royal Trail Works, and our good friend Daniel Leibowitz. We'll get to the story about the former Ecuadorian exchange student who came to the Randolph Union High School in the late 90s in just a moment. Let's finish up this piece from Alpa Mayo. It's called Clavel Palais. Past 11, if you're catching Green Zine live on this Thanksgiving 2024, Todd in the studio with you and looking at the paper that just came out yesterday. It's our weekly paper of record, the White River Valley Herald. And from the front page, the headline is Randolph Union Exchange Student Returns and Discusses Amazon Restoration. We're going to be focusing a lot on trees, mostly here in Vermont, with a special section coming up from Vermont Digger in just a few minutes. But let's travel to the Amazon, a story written by the publisher and editor of the Herald, Tim Calabro. I'll just tell you a little bit about it. Maria Jose Iturralde, a dedicated environmentalist from Ecuador, returned to Randolph last week to speak at the Bethany Church about her efforts to empower indigenous communities to and restore ecosystems in the Amazon rainforest and the Andes Mountains. Music just heard was clearly from the Andes Mountains. The presentation titled Collective Reworlding Through Feminine and Indigenous Power captivated an audience in Randolph. So the former, she was here in 96 and 97, returned to her home country of Ecuador, and she co-founded Pachayansana, an organization committed to environmental and cultural restoration. As she says, she's quoted here, Pacha means the world or the planet, and Aisana means balance in Quechua. Our mission is to restore territories back to their previous ecosystems and help communities reclaim their indigenous identities. Iturralde emphasized that Pachayansana's efforts go far beyond tree planting. Her organization partners with indigenous often women-led organizations. I'm going to turn the page here, so hang on just a moment. Communities that regenerate ecosystems and cultural pride. When a community is proud of who they are as an indigenous group and connected to their culture, they protect their forests much better. She detailed how the work begins with restoring the soil, a subject we've talked about quite a bit here on Green Zine with Henry, before reintroducing native plants and trees. Restoration is hard work. You have to find seeds, propagate them in a nursery, plant them, and then follow up to see if they survive. Beyond ecological restoration, Pachasayana's initiatives also address food security, creating biodiverse food forests using ancestral agricultural techniques. Iturralde discussed the challenges posed by industries in her country, such as cattle ranching, palm oil plantations, and monoculture farming, which degrade the Amazon's fragile ecosystems. She noted that once cleared, the Amazon's clay-based soil loses the connective root system provided by its trees. Once you cut the forest, the rain comes down, washes all the nutrients out. In 3 years, it's gone. She also highlighted the harmful impact of monoculture crops like coffee and cacao. A lot of the coffee that comes to this country, a lot of the cacao, so coffee, chocolate, and we have palm oil, are destroying the Amazon. The Amazon's biodiversity is under threat from deforestation and extractive industries. Cattle ranching is terrible because they cut the forest, plant the grass, which is invasive, and that doesn't let the forest come back. The organization's approach includes providing financial incentives for restoration. We pay families to become restorers of their territory, she explained. This model not only restores ecosystems, but also ensures communities can sustain themselves without resorting to harmful practices. To fund her group's efforts, Pachasayana collaborates with international donors and brings college students to Ecuador for study abroad programs. These students contribute to the community while learning about environmental justice and indigenous culture, she said. You can read the entire article in today's Herald of Randolph. You're tuned to Green Zine, and as I said, we're going to focus on a lot of music dealing with the forest. In fact, this next song deals with taking down the forest in the Amazon. I think you'll know it. Bruce Cockburn, If a Tree Falls.
Wildlife at a rate of a species every single day. Take out people who lived with this for 100,000 years. Inject a billion burgers worth of beef. Grain eaters. Spencer's. Through thinning ozone, waves fall on wrinkled earth. Gravity, light, ancient refuse of stars speak of a drowning. But this is something other. Busy monster eats dark holes in the spirit world, where wild things have to go to disappear forever.
Well, we have an old growth forest segment coming up in just a few minutes. So we're going to move from Bruce Cockburn speaking about the Amazon and the diminished rainforest to a classic song from the British folk group Pentangle. The trees, they do grow high.
Yeah. 16 on his grave the cross was green. Cruel death had put an end to his growing. I'll make my love a shroud of a harem so fine. Every stitch I put in it, the tears come trickling down. Once I had a true
That's a classic traditional English folk song there, interpreted by Pentangle. Another great version of that, and Big Dog might be listening, and fans of Irish music. Alton does basically the same story and similar lyrics, a song that they call Daily Growing. And I think that can be found on the album The Blue Marble, something like that. Anyway, Alton, A-L-T-A-N, featuring a lot of music on today's Green Zine without my co-host Henry. It is a holiday, so we're not going to have a guest today, but we do have a special tape here that Henry sent along to me. I really appreciate it. Henry, in case you're listening or you're listening to the rebroadcast, he puts up a lot of notes at our Green Zine link at the website. So if you want to catch up on some past shows or what's coming up or find some links to various environmental activities that are happening in our area, check us out at WFVR.org. Well, one of our other nonprofit media, about the same age as us, they are, I think, just celebrating their 15th anniversary, and I'm talking about Vermont Digger. And they have an environment section, and they just put out this podcast under that section. It's called The Deeper Dig, In the Forest, A Patch of Common Ground. And it's produced by Riley Robinson and Emma Cotton. Now, Emma Cotton is a reporter for Vermont Digger. And Henry, if you are listening to this, I think we could have a very interesting interview with Emma Cotton. So let's go to this piece. In the Forest, A Patch of Common Ground, as the Southbounder approaches, train still running even with the snow.
So having a couple places that are already here that we protect now, you know, we'll start to see a lot of those old forest characteristics developing in the next couple decades, whereas a lot of forests, it's going to take, you know, even many that we own, it's going to take 100 years for them to start to feel old or more. So, you know, capturing some of these halfway there places is a great head start on getting all the way there.
From VT Digger, this is The Deeper Dig. I'm Riley Robinson. What does it mean to conserve forests? When is human intervention helpful, and when should we just leave the trees alone? It's an age-old debate in the field of forestry, and it cuts to the heart of a bill before Vermont state lawmakers.
This morning we will be taking up H-126, an act relating to community resilience and biodiversity protection.
As it turns out, a lot of folks working in forestry don't see it as an either-or situation. To them, it's not a competition between preservation and logging or wildlands versus active management.
The bill touches on what is currently a pretty contentious issue within the forestry and conservation community.
I spoke with my colleague, Emma Cotton, about this complicated balancing act. Emma covers the environment, energy, agriculture, and climate change for VT Digger.
So you went out trekking around with Shelby Perry, who's a wildlands ecologist, and you were out in the Woodbury Mountain Wilderness Preserve. What was Shelby looking for out there?
Yeah, the Woodbury Mountain Wilderness Preserve is this 6,000-acre stretch of land in Woodbury. And it has recently been preserved by the Northeast Wilderness Trust as a forever wild land. So there's very limited human intervention that would ever happen in those woods. It's protected from logging. It's open for some types of recreation. And that's pretty much it.
So we're approaching very steep, which is Good news for Old Forest, and bad news for tired legs.
We were roaming around looking for Old Forest to see whether the land contained patches of trees that were 100 to 150 years old, to see if there were places where there were complex structures in the ecosystem. She was looking for sort of mossy, spongy soil and downed trees and all of the things that a forest would sort of do on its own when it hasn't been touched by people.
But this forest is a teenager. And the forest, you know, when it's all grown up, feels really, really different. And we have a handful of places where that's already true, but we don't have very many, and they're really, really hard to get to. And so most people don't get to experience that.
Shelby, I think, had a knack for sort of just looking around and taking stock of what was there. She also was coring some trees. So when she thought that, you know, a tree might be a certain age, she would sit down next to it and take out her core, which is like this thin metal rod. She would sort of twist it into the tree trunk and pull out a very thin sliver of the tree's flesh and count its rings. 15, 16,
17. 19, 20, so that's 70. We'll add maybe 8 to 10 for the ones we missed in the middle of the core and however long it took the tree to get to this height.
Oh.
So we wouldn't have any of the rings that happened before that. So we're probably looking at roughly 100-year-old tree, which is not quite 150. But it's an old tree.
Yeah.
This was new land under the trust, right? So like, when did this land become part of this wilderness trust?
So actually, the sale became finalized the day that we were walking around out there. This land has entered the Northeast Wilderness Trust portfolio alongside a lot of other land across the region. So they're finding that people are becoming more and more interested in conserving land in this specific way, which is to set it aside entirely and not let people log it, which is rare. They're the only regional scale land trust that conserves land this way. Other land trusts allow other types of human activity like logging in that land. So this is a very specific type of conservation easement, and the interest they are reporting is growing.
Just generally, why did you do this? Why did you go up into forest in Woodbury?
I was really interested in this movement that I sort of see taking place across Vermont and parts of the region, where people are becoming more interested in using forest in a different way than we have in the past. So if we just rewind really quickly, in the 1800s, Vermont was clear-cut. Almost all of Vermont's forests were clear-cut for agriculture, for farming. And since then, Vermont has experienced a really huge change, and now 78% of the land is covered in forest. So we've come back from that in a big way. That is due in part to the Green Mountain National Forest becoming established in the state in the 1930s. And also, the state has a program called Current Use, which allows property owners to be taxed on their undeveloped value of their property rather than on its value in the marketplace. Vermont has valued working forests for a really long time, and almost all of our forests have been involved in the logging, the timber industry in some way for a really long time. And people are starting to feel like that should change. And that is due in large part because, you know, due to climate change, because the forest is often recognized as a climate solution. It sequesters a lot of carbon, it stores a lot of carbon, and it can be seen as sort of an easy way, quote unquote easy. Some people see this as an easy way to have the solution. We just leave forests alone and they do all this work. They suck all this carbon out of the atmosphere. And then I think wildlife is another huge reason why people have been interested in conserving forest in many different ways. But when we have large swaths of connected forest, it allows species to migrate. For some people, it's more philosophical than that. It's sort of a matter of letting a forest be a forest for whatever purposes might exist, just sort of allowing it to grow old on its own terms, allowing it to support its own ecology.
You know, of course, Northeast Wilderness Trust would take that forest and say, you live on tree time, we're gonna let you play out your processes on tree time.
Yeah.
And it's hard for humans to do that sometimes because we live on human time. And so that doesn't feel like much in our lifetimes, but our lifetime is not much compared to the lifetime of a tree. So mm-hmm. I think it can come down to personal philosophy too, is, you know,
absolutely, it is.
Nature's left to its own devices is gonna get back to a state of health eventually, and do we want to, or are we willing to wait for that to happen, or do we want to speed it up for ecological, personal, climate change, whatever our reasons might be.
So there's a lot going on, and I think it's safe to say that in this conversation, very few people agree about anything. Everyone has a really different perspective about what should happen and why, and as one forester told me, you know, we're having some really difficult conversations about what we believe forests are and how we want to use them.
There's this philosophical debate, there's this scientific investigation into what forests could or should look like, but this is also playing out politically, right? Can you kind of walk me through what the big political movement has been about forests in Vermont?
Sure. So there are movements that are happening in the state, and there are movements happening nationally that touch Vermont. One example is an executive order that President Biden issued last year, where he sort of set the intention of conserving mature and old growth forest across the country. That executive order hasn't come yet with a set of policies that really affect change on the ground. I think a lot is being debated because, again, people don't agree on a lot of things, even, you know, such as the definition of what a mature forest is or what an old growth forest is. So there's a lot that needs to be ironed out there, but that executive order has the potential to impact projects that are going on in Vermont. For example, there's a project in Rutland County where 11,000 acres of land would be opened up for logging. And a lot of that's taking place on mature forest, on old, what's considered old forest. So that could be impacted.
I want to ask you about old growth, because I know you've also described some forests as just old forests. I've heard this term old growth forests for forever, but I am not really clear on what it means. What is old growth?
Yeah, absolutely. That's such a good question. No one agrees on what old growth means. Everyone has a different definition. I think the strictest definition that the most people could probably get behind is that so forests that have never been touched by human intervention and that have never been touched by natural disturbance definitely qualify. Those are old growth forests. Trees that have been standing for hundreds of years that have escaped all types of disturbance qualify as old growth. Some people argue that a forest impacted by natural disturbance still counts because it's still, that's a natural process, and disturbance, you know, is part of a healthy ecosystem in forests. So if there's a hurricane that came and knocked a bunch of trees down, that those trees will dissolve into the soil and create, you know, healthy complex structures for different types of wildlife. Other people say that that doesn't count. Some people think that old growth forests can be forests that were once entirely cleared and 300 years from now will eventually have their own type of complexity and will have grown old. So there are a lot of different definitions, this is partly why when people say we need to protect old growth forests, it becomes, you know, so intense and prickly because nobody agrees on what it means.
And do we have pockets of old growth in Vermont?
We do have pockets of old growth in Vermont, typically where it's impossible for logging equipment to reach those areas. So in really steep ravines on really steep, you know, mountainsides, that's where you're going to see quote unquote old growth forest. It is, most people say it is less than 1% of the composition of the forest in the state, because so much of it was clear cut when the Europeans came and settled in Vermont.
I also wanted to ask you about this. I think a lot of people, when they hear logging, they might think you just cut down everything. But what does it actually look like?
It looks different depending on the circumstance. I think there is definitely clear cutting that happens in Vermont. There's also a lot of logging in Vermont that isn't clear cutting. I did a field trip with a logger, Sam Lincoln, who owns a business in Randolph Center.
He's trying to cut, make sure each of the four sides of the log is called the face. Mm-hmm. So he's trying to make sure that he has at least two clear faces on a log that's going to go to a sawmill.
Got it.
And he had this machine that would sort of very precisely move in between trees and take one tree down and then extract that tree so it didn't touch any of the others on its way out. And, you know, in some areas there are patch cuts, so you're clearing, you know, a certain amount of forest and leaving others. You know, I think there are a lot of different approaches. I do think clear cutting is probably the most widely talked about in the media and elsewhere, as, you know, sort of a symbol of what can be damaging. But then Sam Lincoln, you know, mentioned that some of the clear cuts he does are to create pasture for organic farms. And, you know, I think there's a lot of nuance to every piece of this. But it looks entirely different depending on the logging job and what's requested from the landowner.
So I know we had a couple sidebars here about old growth and what that means, but to bring it back to policy, you've told me a little bit about what's going on at the federal level. Can you tell me what's going on just within the state of Vermont?
On a statewide level, there's a few different initiatives that are going on. One is a bill that has already become a law that passed last session, which creates a new category in the state's current use program. So that tax incentive for property owners to keep undeveloped land undeveloped, you know, that has historically applied to working forests and agriculture. There's a new category that would allow property owners to only manage their lands for ecological benefits. And this is really interesting too, because, you know, it's been a trade for a long time. So people have received a tax incentive in exchange for providing an economic benefit. I will, you know, get a little bit off my taxes and I'll sell, you know, I'll participate in the wood products industry. But now these ecological benefits are sort of being seen as a public good. So it's sort of a shift in the way that we think about, again, think about forests and what they can do for us.
Okay. Tell me about this current bill that you're watching.
So H-126 is a state bill working through the State House in Vermont that proposes conserving 30% of Vermont's land by 2030. This bill passed both chambers last session, but was vetoed by the governor. And it proposes conserving 30% of Vermont's land by 2030, which is, you know, echoes a President Biden initiative. And this bill gets into the weeds of sort of the debate of, you know, forest ecology right now. So it basically would require state officials to implement a document, which is called Vermont Conservation Design. And it makes specific recommendations for how we should manage forest in the state. And it says that we should set around 9% of the state's forest aside to be forever wild. So not touched, not part of the timber industry. And then there are other categories too. Some of the forest that is conserved would have logging take place on it, and some of it would be open for humans to alter the forest based on ecological benefits. The bill has gotten a lot of feedback. A lot of people appreciate that it walks the line of including those three different categories, but there are a lot of opinions about the bill.
It sounds like one of the big questions here is, what should conservation mean, right? Like, and how much human intervention is good for forests? If the debate is, are forests best left untouched? Can humans do a better job at managing them than nature on its own? Is logging a form of conservation in itself in forest management? Am I like reading the room right here?
Absolutely, yes. All of those questions are being asked. And I think people are wondering what conservation means in this context. And I think the answer in many ways is that it means a lot of different things. One of the words that I heard over and over from every single person I interviewed on this was balance. Everyone wants balance, but everyone wants a different kind of balance. So I spoke with Bill Keaton, who is a researcher at UVM, who has studied old growth forests for a long time. He calls himself an old growth advocate. He also advocates for a mixed approach. So he believes that we should set pieces of the forest aside to never be touched. And then we should complement that by having pieces of the forest where we alter it for, you know, ecosystem benefits. And then he also believes that, you know, there is a place for sustainable timber harvesting.
And I see these as complementary approaches: wilderness and wildlands and sustainably managed working forests. We need both. They go together.
Bill and others in the state frequently get really frustrated by this, what they call a false dichotomy, that has sort of been taking place across the media landscape, across forums where this is being discussed, where people think, you know, you either have to set forests aside or you have to actively, intensively manage it. And it's an either or situation. Their argument is that we can accomplish a lot of these goals across the landscape in different ways.
We recommend a variety of approaches, and you can find good science that supports each of those. The danger is simplifying this issue by advocating that there should be only one solution, or one solution is the best, when in fact, there's science that supports all of these solutions, and each one carries risks and pros and cons and trade-offs, which is probably why we need a portfolio of approaches. So yeah, the science is complicated. The science is contentious. Scientists themselves disagree about many of these things. There's an active debate within the scientific community. And that's exactly why in a situation like this, we shouldn't put all of our eggs in one basket. We need to spread the risk.
Can you tell me a little bit more about some loggers' perspective on this? Like, how do they see their work as fitting into this conservation mission?
So in Vermont, forest-based businesses, including maple syrup, Christmas trees, and the forest products industry, contribute around $861 million in sales to the state's economy every year. That's according to the Department of Forest, Parks, and Recreation. The industry also employs about 6,600 people. Of course, all of those people are going to have a different perspective about how the forest should be managed and how this conservation work should go.
But we're looking at this white wood here, the heartwood. Yeah. The smaller the heart, the better.
Sam Lincoln actually testified on this bill, H-126, that proposes different levels of forest conservation across the state. He is not a fan for some nuanced reasons. His argument is that landowners across Vermont have been voluntarily conserving their forests for a long time. Through the current use program and through landowners forestry plans that they have for their property, they are voluntarily choosing, you know, not to clear cut their forest, not to put housing developments on their land, that kind of thing. So he's sort of saying property owners should be able to decide what they want to do with their land. And a really important asterisk here is that 80% of forests in the state of Vermont are privately owned. So whatever we do needs to have agreement from landowners. So he's sort of, he says he's an advocate for property rights and that landowners should be able to choose and that landowners are already doing a lot of good work. He's also concerned about the reserved forest land piece of this, that 10% would be set aside. He said that he isn't opposed to, you know, old growth forests or older forests being conserved, but he sees that wood product demand for wood products is rising.
And when I talk about all this and when all these people say, well, we're just going to stop log. We've decided that single use of forests is to sequester carbon and that's it, and we're going to stop logging. To me, that is totally uninformed lack of awareness. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't, like I said, it doesn't mean we should cut every tree in every place all the time. By no means am I saying that, but it means, like, it just means if we're not cutting trees here is not a net decrease of cutting trees in the region or on the planet. Right. That fiber is going to be used to create those essential goods from somewhere. Do we want it to come from Siberia? Do we want it to come from South America? Or do we want to do it here where we can be everybody out, be part of our economy, part of our sourcing of our essential goods?
We're sort of exporting our burden somewhere else if we don't cut these trees here.
Just so I understand, he has some concerns about private property rights. Is this bill telling landowners what to do with their land? What exactly is going on there?
This bill is setting a goal of conserving 30% of the total landmass of Vermont by 2030. But if you think about the fact that 80% of the land, of the forest land in Vermont is privately owned, you can assume that some of that protected land is going to have to be on private property.
I was going to ask you, so, like, does this bill come out on one side of the debate or the other, whether to leave the forests be, to manage them with human intervention? But it seems like that question is too simple.
I think what we can say is that the bill prioritizes permanent conservation, which some people are concerned about because, you know, we wouldn't be able to take that conservation, you know, protection away later if we needed to. In terms of the people who are having a debate about how our forests should be used, so environmentalists and the people involved in sustainable management, sort of that, those people among that school of thought are excited about the fact that the bill has different options for conservation. So we're going to set some pieces aside, some pieces are going to be available for continued management. So it doesn't, you know, say 70% of the land in Vermont is going to be permanently protected and set aside forever. But I think there is a lot of nuance when you think about how this might impact the wood products industry in the state. The problem, I think, so your question was, does it come out on one side or the other? And I think the tricky part is that there are so many different sides. You know, there are so many different people with different perspectives at this bill. A lot of people say that it does strike a good balance. A lot of people don't.
Emma Cotton covers the environment, climate change, energy, and agriculture for VT Digger. And you can read more of her work at vtdigger.org. You can subscribe to the show wherever you stream podcasts. This episode used music from Blue Dot Sessions. And as always, thank you for listening. We'll be back in your feed soon.
Well, I want to thank the good folks at Vermont Digger for providing that show for the public here in Vermont and folks that might want to be listening to it from further away. You are tuned to Green Zine here at Free Vermont Radio, Royalton Community Radio. Going to bring up some more tree music underneath me here. This piece is called Forest, some Celtic tradition. Travels into the Woods by Martin Czerny. Well, we've got about 13 minutes left in the show. Definitely wanted to touch base on a couple of more items here as we continue to play some music. 7 days, which actually got a little thumbs up from the New York Times, apparently, in the last couple of weeks. My partner and I watched a film about the difficulty of newspapers surviving in the current capitalist and, vulture capitalism, hedge funds, etc., buying up papers and stripping them down. But 7 days is hanging in there. And a gentleman that we have interviewed before on Greenzine has his story this week. His name is Kevin McCallum, and this is under the environment section. If you pick up the current 7 days, you'll find it on page 14. Article is called Break Time, and it shows our governor off to the side at a pit stop having a sandwich in this cartoon. And the subheadline is Governor Phil Scott vowed that Vermont would meet the targets in the Paris Accord. Now he's not so sure. These are the words of the writer Kevin McCallum. Vermont is not on track to meet its 2030 climate emission reduction commitment, but instead of accelerating to reach that mile marker, Governor Phil Scott wants lawmakers to let him throttle back. Scott says the cuts in carbon pollution would come at too high a cost for many Vermonters, especially those facing sharply higher property taxes and other expenses. We'll continue to do our part, but at a pace we can afford, Scott said at a recent press conference. Lawmakers and climate activists are incensed. They argue that Scott has been a Sunday driver on climate initiatives for years, so Vermont is no nearer to its goals. And now, with an impending deadline, they say Scott should be hitting the gas. He is retreating at exactly the time when bold leadership is essential, said Paul Burns, executive director of VPIRG. Whether Vermont lives up to its climate commitments is shaping up to be one of the fiercest fights of the upcoming 2025 legislative session. Scott and his Republican allies, reinvigorated by electoral gains that eliminated the Democrats' veto-proof supermajority, say Vermont can't afford to meet existing goals. Climate activists and many of their Democratic allies say the state can't afford not to. Lawmakers must decide next year whether to continue on the path they have laid out to reduce the use of fossil fuels to heat Vermont homes and businesses. In 2023, they enacted the Clean Heat Standard and tasked the PUC with fleshing out a mechanism that would, over time, convert homes heated with natural gas, oil, and propane to lower carbon sources of heat. More recently, studies have suggested this clean heat transition would be tricky to administer and would raise the price of fossil heating fuels. That's something Scott and many newly elected Republicans have vowed to prevent. Now Scott is signaling that he wants not only to block the clean heat standard, but also to unwind the 2020 law upon which it is based, the Global Warming Solutions Act. In 2017, Scott pledged that Vermont would stay the course to meet the targets of the Paris Agreement, the landmark international climate treaty from which then-President Donald Trump withdrew. Legislators enshrined the state's climate goals in law. The Global Warming Solutions Act calls for Vermont to reduce its carbon emissions to 26% below 2005 levels by next year, 40% below 1990 levels by 2030, and 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. If Vermont isn't on track to achieve these goals, the law allows advocates to sue and ask a judge to order the state to take more drastic measures. As you've heard on this show, the first lawsuit has already been filed. The plaintiff, the Conservation Law Foundation, says the state is likely to miss the imminent 2025 goal. By delaying the target set for 2030, Scott hopes to buy the state some time, protect Vermonters from higher fuel costs, and avoid what he sees as inevitable litigation. We can't put unrealistic goals out there and then wait to be sued, Scott said. That just slows everything down and impacts us financially and doesn't really attain the goals that we hold. The state faces multiple crises at the moment, including a lack of housing, workforce challenges, and flood recovery, Scott said. Climate change, he added, remains a concern, but can't be the only one. We have to pick and choose. We can't have all of them be our focus. On the issue of emissions reductions, Scott says he has ideas for, quote, ways to make the goals more attainable and more cost-effective in the long run, but said he would not provide details until lawmakers meet in January. His ideas will likely get a better reception after an election in which the GOP picked up 18 seats in the Vermont House and 6 in the Senate. Democrats say they've received the message about affordability loud and clear and will make it their top legislative priority, though the immediate focus will be property taxes. Changing existing climate policy is certain to receive pushback from advocates and some lawmakers. A little bit later in this article, Jared Duvall is mentioned, and I'm just going to make sure I identify him. Yes, he is the head of the Energy Action Network, and he pushes back pretty hard on the comments that the governor has made about gearing back on these changes. Right now, we're going to shift gears again. We've got about 7.5 minutes left in the show, and if I get this right, we are going to listen to a audio portion of an article written just the other day in the New York Times. This is an interesting. We all know that the incoming president, Donald Trump, has said that he will basically stop any support for the production of EVs. Well, he's getting a little pushback from sort of an interesting place. The title of this article, Automakers to Trump, Please Require Us to Sell Electric Vehicles. Let's take a listen, and then we'll come back one more time here. You're listening to Green Zine on Royalton Community Radio.
Three of the nation's largest automakers, Ford, General Motors, and Stellantis, are strategizing with other car manufacturers on how to make a delicate request of President-elect Donald J. Trump: don't scrap the federal regulations that compel the industry to sell electric vehicles. The conversation would require diplomatic finesse. Mr. Trump has railed against the EV rules, which strictly limit the amount of tailpipe pollution while also ramping up fuel economy standards. They are designed to get car makers to produce more EVs and have been a cornerstone of President Biden's fight against climate change. Mr. Trump sees them differently. He has falsely said the rules amount to a Democratic mandate that would prevent Americans from buying the gasoline-powered cars of their choice, a concern of his campaign donors from the oil industry. And Mr. Trump still holds grievances against some of the automakers, whom he views as having betrayed him because during his first term they supported Obama-era auto emissions rules. In fact, most automakers don't love the more stringent rules Mr. Biden put in place, but they have already invested billions in a transition to electric vehicles and fear that if Mr. Trump made an abrupt change as he has promised, they could be undercut by automakers who sell cheaper gas-powered cars. They argue it would harm an industry that is a backbone of American manufacturing and employs 1.1 million people. Lobbyists and officials from several car companies say the automakers want the Biden regulations to remain largely intact, with some changes, such as more time for compliance and lower penalties for companies that don't meet the requirements. One wild card in negotiations is Elon Musk, the top Trump advisor and chief executive of Tesla, which accounts for half of electric vehicle sales in the United States. In a previously unreported November 12th letter to Mr. Trump, John Bezzella, president of the Alliance for Automotive Innovation, which represents 42 car companies that produce nearly all the new vehicles sold in the United States, wrote that in order for the auto industry to remain successful and competitive, it needed stability and predictability in auto-related emissions standards. Transportation is the sector of the U.S. economy that produces the most greenhouse gases, pollution that is dangerously heating the planet. The Obama administration was the first to limit tailpipe emissions of such pollution. During his first term, Mr. Trump effectively erased those rules, replacing them with standards that were little more than business as usual. Mr. Biden restored and, with input from the automakers, significantly strengthened the tailpipe rules, making them the biggest regulations enacted by the federal government to fight climate change. The regulations affect vehicles starting in model year 2027 and grow more stringent through 2032. Automakers could comply by selling a mix of gasoline-burning cars, hybrids, EVs, or other types of vehicles, such as cars powered by hydrogen. The EPA estimates that compliance with the rule would mean that by 2032, about 56% of new passenger vehicles sold would be electric, and another 16% would be hybrids, up from about 9% and 11% today, respectively. Car companies that don't meet the new restrictions could face substantial penalties or could purchase emissions credits from companies that have exceeded the standards by selling more EVs. Tesla, which makes only electric vehicles, has earned billions of dollars by selling emissions credits to other automakers, collecting $2.1 billion in the first 9 months of this year alone, which was 43% of its net profit, according to regulatory filings. During Tesla's early years, the credits were a critical source of revenue that probably prevented the company from going bankrupt, analysts say.
Very interesting factoid there about changing those EV carbon credits and making a whole lot of money off it. That's pretty much news to me. Hey, we're going to cover, I think, one more story here and one more piece of music as we get near the end of the hour of our Thanksgiving edition of Green Zine here at WFVRLP in South Royalton. And I have picked out one more piece. We're kind of having a gentle storm outside. And this is from a group that has played in Vermont. They're no longer together. And sticking with the tree theme, Night Tree, from their album Dedications. Well, I did want to go to this one more story here. Back to EVs. Most of you who follow national politics know that the governor of California, Gavin Newsom, is very bullish about the environment and EVs, and he announced the other day that the state is planning to provide its residents with a $7,500 rebate. That's different than a tax credit for purchase of electric vehicles if the incoming Trump administration eliminates the federal EV tax credit. Trump's transition team has indicated that killing the federal EV tax credit is a priority, as it's viewed as an easy target in a likely Republican-controlled Congress and could provide some cost savings to help offset trillions of dollars in soon-to-expire tax cuts the incoming administration is expected to renew. Further down in this story, which I'm taking from Green Car Reports, is the fact that one car company that would not be part of this program and is the only company that actually manufactures EVs in the state of California is Tesla. I don't make this stuff up. Elephant's Dream. Actually, well, I did that show already. How about Green Zine has been brought to you on this Thanksgiving by Soloflect, Building a Local Economy, Royal Trail Works, Daniel Leibowitz, the Upper Pass Beer Company, First Branch Coffee Company, all these folks probably reopening tomorrow, Solar Fest, more about them next week, White River Land Collaborative, Wit and Grit. We appreciate your ears, your listenership, your membership, etc., for supporting WFVRLP, South Royalton, radio of the people, by the people, for the people. Stay tuned for Democracy Now!